Thanks, Randy. Thanks, Scott, for the invitation to come talk to you today, and thanks, everyone, for being part of the session here. This is kind of a long title, and it's more representing the approaches that I take as a catchment scientist, trying to think about how catchments fit into landscapes. So what are the processes throughout the subsurface profiles that affect what we see in terms of water that flows off these landscapes and the solutes that are transported from these landscapes? Natalie Griffiths is a co-author in this. She's at Oak Ridge National Lab, and we've been working together on the Spruce Project in northern Minnesota. I'm not going to talk too much about the goals of Spruce. I'll get into a little bit, but essentially it's a large-scale climate manipulation that we are starting to work on. Within that framework, early on, as trying to gather some baseline data for this, we started collecting peat pore water profiles through in a northern peatland in a bog in northern Minnesota, and we were seeing these very strong chemographs, these chemical profiles with depth. So if you look at pH in the upper corner here, you see that it goes from strongly acidic to near circumneutral at 3 meters of depth. Again, total organic carbon concentrations are extremely high in the surface and very low in deep subsurface. Ammonium also shows some very striking patterns of having exceptionally high concentrations deep in the subsurface, up to 3 to 4 parts per million down there. So as a catchment scientist, I want to think about how water moves through these landscapes and what are the flow paths that link these solutes. So why do those patterns vary? Is it due to potentially interactions with the regional aquifer and the effect that groundwater may have at deeper depths, which could explain some of those higher pHs and the lower concentrations of organic carbon? Or does it reflect vertical transport due to hydraulic head and how that may affect things? Or is it due to the biogeochemical processing? And ultimately, how does flow through the water, how does flow through the different layers in this peatland become reflected at the landscape level for transport downstream, where there can be a lot more processing of these chemicals? So that's, in a nutshell, what got me started thinking about a lot of this. I got to tell you that it was a pretty messy story bringing all this together, because every time I would start going down one avenue, I would start to get more and more questions about this. So I'm going to try and walk you through some of the conceptual approaches that I bring to this. A lot of the different data related to what we've collected in the early stages of the Spruce experiment, and also 50 years of ecosystem research that helps inform some of the ideas I'm going to talk about today. The other context of this is trying to think about how climate change will affect the chemistry along these profiles due to changing cycling, a lot of which Evan nicely introduced in the last presentation, and Jason and Colleen and others are going to be talking about later in this session, but also how flow paths may change. If we expect warmer air temperatures and longer growing seasons in the future, how will that affect water tables, and again, how will that affect the flow of water, which ultimately transports these solutes from peatlands. So getting into this, if we think about northern carbon in northern peatlands, peatlands are really hot spots for carbon storage. If we look at the map over on the right-hand side there, those black areas are carbon stores on essentially a 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, or the several kilometer surface area at the Marcel Experimental Forest. The black areas are the high carbon areas, and those are all peatlands. So you see that 50% of the terrestrial carbon is stored in organic soils of peatlands, and that's just 13% of this northern Minnesota landscape. If you think globally, 33% of soil carbon is stored in peatlands, which is an even smaller fraction, only 3% of the Earth's surface. So the overall conclusion is that quantifying carbon cycling in and fluxes from peatlands will be critical to understanding tipping points of global carbon storage, cycling, and feedbacks on climate as we move into a future where there's higher carbon dioxide concentrations and warmer air temperatures. If we look at some of the early data from the preliminary Spruce data reporting, we can see that dissolved organic matter, which is really going to be a focus for the solute of concern for my talk, is that dissolved organic matter is an important carbon flux in these ecosystems. It may be small as a fraction of other stores in the landscape, but what the DOM represents is a solute that's highly degradable and available for processing and burial downstream. In particular, I think of peatlands as a source of dissolved organic matter. It can move rapidly via surface flow paths and into streams and into lakes. And then it's in the lakes where you have a lot more processing that could lead to other feedbacks on global climate. If that dissolved organic matter is processed and releases carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases, or there's the other possible mechanism, which would be a negative feedback on climate change, would be burial in sediments where it would be stabilized in there. So the dissolved organic matter, as it moves from peatlands to downstream ecosystems, really has important consequences for carbon cycling and climate at a global scale. So again, thinking about the distributions of northern peatlands, again, it becomes important when we think about the spatial area. There's the map just showing peatlands in northern Minnesota and the vast aerial coverage. And if we look at this diagram from Weider and Witt, we can see that looking down in the pool, we can see the distribution of northern peatlands. Now, one of the interesting things is that the southern fringe of these northern peatlands, which Minnesota is represented in there, there, some of the sites are going to be most vulnerable to climate change. It's the southern extent, and it's the areas where we see the air temperatures will be warmer and atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations will be higher in future conditions, with those greatest temperature shifts at higher latitudes. So again, these temperature shifts could lead to a regime where these peatlands become destabilized in future climates, because they're at that southern edge and they're very vulnerable to shifts in climate. So if we think just in terms of the northern Minnesota landscape, since the 1960s, we've already seen an approximately 2 degrees Celsius increase in air temperature. The growing season is longer by about 30 days than it was in the 1960s, and snowmelt occurs 2 weeks earlier. So we already see some vast changes in climate and in hydrology of these ecosystems. One way of thinking about it, if we look at this conceptual diagram of peatland and a landscape, we have precipitation coming in, we have evapotranspiration leading to water moving back to the atmosphere, we've got stream flow, and we've got pathways where there's movement of water from peatlands into the regional aquifer. With longer vegetation growing season and warmer air temperatures, in the future, we know that the balance between evapotranspiration and runoff pathways will change. The expected outcome is peatland drying as evapotranspiration increases relative to runoff. So we're facing a future in which we may have drying of peatlands during certain times of the year related to evapotranspirative processes. And really trying to think about how those... it really started me in the process of developing a bunch of questions to think about how climate change will affect subsurface processes and feedbacks on streams and landscapes. So some of these questions are, how will climate change drive interactions between hydrology and biogeochemical processes in the subsurface in northern peatlands? How will such changing interactions affect solutes, particularly organic matter affluxes via stream flow? If peatlands become drier, is it probable that flow paths would shift to link deeper subsurface processes to stream solute yields? Or is it just simply a disconnection of those surface processes from solute yields to streams and other downstream water bodies? And again, I think the overarching question for me is biogeochemical processing in deep subsurface organic soils relevant to downstream dissolved organic matter affluxes and processing? Now, I do want to be very clear that I never want to imply that changes in hydrology and changes in deep subsurface processing would be unimportant, because clearly they are. Changing nutrient availability due to changing cycle at depth has vast implications for primary production and greenhouse gas emissions from these peatlands. I'm just thinking again more as a catchment scientist and how these ecosystems are linked via the flow of water to other downstream ecosystems. So I'm going to focus on peatlands at the southern extent of the northern boreal biome. And I'm going to approach these questions as a catchment hydrologist would. I'm going to look at catchment water and solute mass balances, long-term monitoring from research catchments and what we learned from those catchments. I'm going to look at pore water profiles, and if I have time, I'll get into some results from a geochemical mixing analysis to help give some insight on how the different zones in the subsurface of peatlands are linked to what we should see at the whole watershed flux scale for dissolved organic matter. And again, one way that I think about this are that solutes originate from atmospheric deposition, leaching of organic soils, mineral weathering, and biogeochemical processes, all of which are depicted in that cartoon on the left-hand side with the different landscape features. And then it's intermittent flow that transports solutes from peatlands to streams. So as you see in the diagram on the right-hand side, there's various stages of drying and wetting. So you may start with the peatland that has no surface flow out. Under a wetter circumstance, uplands may connect and be part of the game for water and solutes moving through the landscape to streams. But then you may also have other drier scenarios where there's still enough water moving through the landscape to sustain stream flow, but only the peatlands connected and only the peatland processes are linked to what we would see in a stream outflow chemistry. And again, here's where I'm just going to give a quick introduction to the SPRUCE experiment. This is going to be the largest attempted whole ecosystem warming experiment. We started planning this back in 2009. It's a joint effort between Oak Ridge National Lab and the Forest Service. It's funded by the DOE. You can see the part of an 8.1 hectare black spruce sphagnum peatland in northern Minnesota at the Marcel Experimental Forest. You see boardwalks that have been put in place. There are 17 chambers off of that boardwalk. Each chamber is about 12 meters from side to side of those boardwalks. And we are just at right now starting the process of building below ground and above ground structures, which will allow us to do deep soil heating and air heating inside of these large chambers. Chambers that are large enough to include the entire ecosystem, so the entire black spruce trees down to the sphagnum and the microtopography in there. So really this is intended to be an experiment to assess the response of northern peatland ecosystems to increased air temperature and elevated exposure to elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations. Once we start it next year, it'll run for 10 years, and I believe Colleen and Jason will both be talking about aspects of SPRUCE as well. So I'm not going to go too much more into it, other than saying that we're going to have some nice mechanisms in the future to test a lot of these ideas. What I'm going to do today is talk about some of the preliminary data, some of the retrospective analysis of the long-term data from the Marcel Experimental Forest that'll help to inform us of, help us develop some hypotheses of how connected is this peatland, what areas of the subsurface are connected to the regional aquifer or the streams, and how does that really help us to conceptualize how we use all the data from SPRUCE to parameterize global Earth system models, and how relevant are the processes that are occurring here to our thoughts about the role of peatlands in global climate. So at the Marcel Experimental Forest, we have research watersheds in the landscape that includes uplands, bogs, fens, lakes, and streams. We have 50 plus years of environmental monitoring and other large-scale experiments since the site was established in 1961. I'm going to be talking about several different bogs and fens on this property, but in general, we can think about the landscape as this. There are deep glacial aquifers up to 50 meters of outwash sands where the peatlands and the different landscape features have formed. The peatlands are undrained. There are central peatlands. A stream originates from the peatland, but there are no headwater streams into most of these watersheds. There are black spruce sphagnum or shrub sphagnum vegetation communities. And to the extent that the uplands are connected to the peatlands, the upland soils are mineral soils with either deciduous or coniferous forest on them. We have fens and bogs that we study, so the fens can be conceptualized as flow-through systems where you have organic soils and shallow depressions, groundwater can flow through them, which allows evapotranspiration of water from the surface as well as usually a stream flowing from the peatland as well. The other system is quite different, where we have usually a perched watershed with a bog that is formed either several to many meters above the regional groundwater table. So as rain comes in, that rainwater can follow a pathway via evapotranspiration back to the atmosphere. It can flow to a stream, or some of the water can slowly percolate out the bottom. And these bogs have formed deep organic soils and isolated ice block depressions in the landscape. There is some hydrogeologic variation among the bogs, even though they're all raised dome bogs, and most of them are forested with black spruce sphagnum communities on them. So you can see the diagram for the S2 watershed shows about a 7-meter hydraulic head, with the peat being much deeper but much more isolated from the groundwater. Whereas in the S1 watershed, which is where the spruce experiment will occur, we can see that there's much more connectivity with the regional groundwater table. And again, that type of diagram for S1 makes me really think about what are driving those vertical profiles in the soil. How much of it is exchange with the regional groundwater table versus different peat composition that may be affecting the profiles, or just different biogeochemical processes. And then again, how ultimately does flow path variation in changing climate conditions really lead to thoughts about how total organic carbon concentrations and effluxes will vary in future climates. And again, thinking about these watersheds, if we think just about a catchment water budget here, we can see that precipitation is on average about 780 millimeters per year. Most of that water goes back to the atmosphere via evapotranspiration. About two-thirds of that goes back to the atmosphere as evapotranspiration. Stream flow is the next biggest component. It's about 25% of the water budget of these, and then losses to deep seepage out the bottom to the regional groundwater table is about 10% of the water budget here. In S1, though, that catchment that's a little bit more connected to the regional groundwater table, it may be a different story. There may be flow through the bottom of that peatland. And here, what I'm showing simply on the graph are just 2 years of data showing the daily data from a bog well. It's near the highest point of the raised dome in the peatland, and then the other four lines are the monthly data from a series of groundwater wells that surround it. So you can see there is a hydraulic gradient from the peatland to the regional groundwater table, and there's almost always a meter of hydraulic head. So what we expect is that there's always a driving force of water flowing from high to low head, so from the bog, the raised dome bog, into the regional groundwater table there. So that in and of itself would suggest that there's bog processes driving those pore water profiles, with the potential for some mixing with regional groundwater table at deeper depths in the peatland. And again, trying to think about how these ecosystems work, it tends to be stream flow as the bog storage fills and then the water spills out above the outlet to flow through a stream. So when water tables rise, water radially flows from the bog dome to the surrounding lag, and that lag zone will coalesce into an outlet stream. What the series of graphs on the right side show are water tables at the top. Once you exceed a certain threshold of water table, you get stream flow, which is shown in the middle panel, and then the total organic carbon yields are shown in the bottom panel. So really, it's that fill and spill that drives the movement of water and total organic carbon out of these peatlands. So anything that would change the patterns of the frequency at which the water table rises above that elevation would really drive stream flow and the carbon yield from this watershed or these types of watersheds. And again, thinking about this diagram of wetting and drying and how intermittent those flow paths may be. So If we think about the long-term data, the plot shows up to 50 years of data in terms of water table fluctuations. So what that shows is the total range. So we can see that the S1 bog has the largest range up to about a meter and a half of water table elevation. So what this really means is that on the worst drought on record, that the water table fell about a meter and a half in this peatland. Again, it starts to give us some indications of how these peatlands would respond to drying conditions and helps inform us about what we may expect in the future. But the water tables typically fluctuate within narrow ranges, and that's simply shown by the standard deviation in the error bars on there. So typically within a year, there's maybe 30 to 40 centimeters of variation there. So in most years, the water table stays in the upper surface where there's a lot of biogeochemical processing, but on a rare occasion, we can get disconnection as the water table drops and you no longer have that fill and spill dynamic that would lead to carbon being transported to streams. And again, another way I wanted to look at this was just think of within years, when do we have carbon moving and what's driving that? So I show precipitation on the top. You see that overall, most of these years are fairly close in their total precipitation, but there's very different patterns of water table elevation due to the timing of the precipitation inputs and the form. So a lot of this represents, you see the decline in water tables in that second panel down, and the rise is driven by a melt of a seasonal snowpack. So that's one important driver of when the water table rises high enough that there's water and soil yields from the peatland. We also see very different patterns of drying late in the summer as well. So again, thinking about this, most of annual yields occur during events, particularly snow melt. You can see when events occur, there's accumulation of water in the water yield plot, and then the organic carbon follows that very closely. But one thing that we notice is that during those large magnitude summer events, they have a disproportional effect on annual yields. And so the cumulative effects of many small rainfall runoff events may exceed yields during the snowmelt or during snowmelt events. And the occurrence and magnitude of growing season events will be most affected by climate, meaning that ET is highest at those times and streams may, the implication being that streams may flow less frequently during the growing season in the future. And another way of looking at this too is the interaction with some of the biogeochemistry and the organic carbon availability is that we see the highest total organic carbon concentrations late during and sometimes after the vegetative growing season. So if we look at volume weighted concentrations, we see that the concentrations are most dilute in March and April when at the time of snowmelt. During summer, the concentrations increase. So again, thinking back about the disproportionate yields of total organic carbon relative to water yields, it is driven by this, which is driven by the processing of organic matter in superficial soils. And that peat is transiently oxygenated and decomposition is highest when water tables fall. The superficial soils are where inputs of litter and biological exudates occur, and that the water flows laterally when peat, when water tables rise and leach that dissolved organic matter from peat. In deeper soils, there's lower hydraulic connectivities and less rapid transport, and carbon is slowly cycled when peat is primarily saturated down there. And again, another way of thinking about this is just to go back to profiles of total organic carbon concentration. If we look at that near surface zone, that's where the highest carbon concentrations are and where we also get the highest water fluxes through there. And the one thing that I meant to show here is if we look at the profile of depth below surface and the saturated hydraulic conductivities, you see that the hydraulic conductivities or the capacity to move water is orders of magnitude higher in surface peat. So that's another feedback of the peat physical properties. When you link it with the availability of carbon in there, you have a potential to move a lot of water and a lot of carbon when water tables rise. And thinking about how that varies over time and space, I'm not going to go into this slide too much. I'm going to skip through some of the geochemical mixing analysis, except to say that the streams on the right always look like the near surface waters. They don't ever show a chemical signature that would indicate that there's any transport from deep subsurface layers that we see at the outlet. So, and I'll just summarize by saying this. So, what happens in the surficial organic soils is most important to DOM and other solute fluxes from northern peatlands. The shallow subsurface flow paths, leaching, and biogeochemical transformations drive DOM fluxes from northern peatlands. So whatever would happen in the future to change the frequency and duration of saturation of those near-surface peats and the development of those flow paths will dramatically affect solute yields. So if those southern boreal peatlands become drier in a warmer climate, the TOC of fluxes will decrease due to less frequent flushing of those flow paths. And the deeper subsurface processing, though potentially important for release of greenhouse gases and changes in nutrient cycling, may be more segregated from the transport processes that drive solute fluxes to outlet streams and processing in downstream ecosystems. So with that, if there's time for questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.